So what he's very subtly doing is pushing the responsibility for the war and for dealing with Putin into the hands of the Europeans and the Ukrainians. Trump understands he cannot coerce the Russians into accepting a ceasefire, and therefore Trump has accepted reality. The fact is that Trump likes Putin. Putin is his kind of guy. Putin is powerful. He's a first-class strategist. And Trump is someone who respects power. I know this is not a popular argument in the West. The Russians were trying to avoid a war. Well, it was the Americans who had no interest in negotiating with Putin and avoiding this war. Germany would have been much better off without a war and maintaining good economic relations and political relations with Russia. So the Europeans are paying a real price here.
Grüezi miteinander, ganz herzlich willkommen und einen wunderschönen guten Tag, meine sehr verehrten Damen und Herren, liebe Freunde aus nah und fern. Ich begrüße Sie zu einer sehr speziellen Sondersendung von Weltwoche Daily, die andere Sicht, unabhängig, kritisch, zuversichtlich, auch im Angesicht des Tohuwabohus der internationalen Politik, aufgezeichnet am Dienstag, dem 19. August 2025, nur wenige Stunden nach dem Gipfeltreffen in Washington mit einer ganzen Corona europäischer Staatenlenker plus Präsident Zelensky, der NATO-Chef Rutte war dort und so weiter. Und wir haben heute einen eminenten Experten bei uns in der Sendung. Ich freue mich außerordentlich, ich fühle mich geehrt. It's a great honor, dass er heute bei uns wieder dabei ist. Es ist Professor John Mearsheimer von der Chicago University, einer der meistgefragten Experten für Geopolitik und der einsame, für mich herausragende Vertreter der realistischen Schule der Politikbetrachtung. Und jetzt werde ich ins Englische wechseln, dass auch er uns versteht. And I extend a warm welcome to John Mearsheimer, Professor Mearsheimer. Dear John, it's great to have you here in Switzerland in our program. And I'm very curious, what's your assessment on current events? Great to have you here.
Thank you very much, Roger. It's a pleasure to be here.
Thanks. Well, we have seen the event yesterday, the summit meeting in Washington. What's the most important takeout of this whole event? What is your assessment of it?
The single most important impression that I take away from the summit is that you have the Europeans and the Ukrainians very close together on the key issues on the table. As I like to say, the Europeans and the Ukrainians are joined at the hip. And in a very important way, President Trump has distanced himself from the Ukrainians and the Europeans. The meeting yesterday was really all about Trump trying to deal with adversaries, dealing with a group of leaders who disliked what he was doing. And of course, we all know Trump has a certain contempt for the Europeans and for President Zelensky. So you had this very interesting dynamic, which I don't think most people have recognized, where it was Trump versus the Ukrainians and the Europeans. And what Trump is trying to do is he's trying to distance himself from this conflict. Trump now realizes that he can't manage an end to the war. It's out of his hands. So what he's very subtly doing, and you saw all sorts of evidence of it yesterday, is pushing the responsibility for the war and for dealing with Putin into the hands of the Europeans and the Ukrainians, who again are working very closely together. So I think there's a fundamental change taking place in terms of how the Trump administration approaches the Ukraine war.
Why do you think that President Trump is not able to come up with a peace solution? Why is it out of his hands. The Americans are very powerful. This president is full of energy. Why his powerlessness in this case in your eyes?
Well, first of all, we want to distinguish between a ceasefire and a genuine peace agreement. And your question had to do with a genuine peace agreement. But let's just deal with a ceasefire as well while we are at it. A lot of European leaders and President Zelensky want a ceasefire. They want an immediate ceasefire, and they want it badly. The Russians simply refuse to move to a ceasefire. Trump understands he cannot coerce the Russians into accepting a ceasefire, and therefore Trump has accepted reality and said there's going to be no ceasefire. The Europeans and Zelensky refuse to accept that argument, and they keep demanding a ceasefire. But this is a waste of time because the Russians are not going to agree to a ceasefire. And Trump recognizes that. So a ceasefire is effectively off the table. And this brings us to the heart of your question, which deals with why Trump, who's the president of the United States and therefore is an incredibly powerful man, is unable to get a deal here, is unable, to be honest, to even get close to getting a deal. The answer is very simple. The Ukrainians and the Europeans on one side and the Russians on the other side have demands that are irreconcilable. Their demands are polar opposites. Just to give you an example, the big three Russian demands on the table are that, first of all, the Europeans and the Americans and Ukraine recognize that Russia has annexed the four oblasts in eastern Ukraine and Crimea. So in other words, we have to recognize that. The Ukrainians and the Europeans absolutely refuse to do that. The second big Russian demand is that Ukraine has to be a genuinely neutral state. That means that Ukraine cannot be a NATO, and there cannot be meaningful security guarantees from the West, especially the United States. The Europeans and President Zelensky categorically reject that Russian demand. The third Russian demand is that Ukraine be disarmed to the point where it does not have offensive military capability that can be used against Russia. The Europeans and President Zelensky categorically reject that demand. And in fact, what the Europeans have made clear is that they want to increase the fighting power of the Ukrainian military, not decrease it. Well, given these three Russian demands, which are clearly non-negotiable, and given the fact that the Europeans and the Ukrainians reject all three of them, how can you possibly get a deal? And the answer is, you can't get a deal. And Donald Trump may be powerful, but there are limits to his power. He cannot coerce either the Russians or the Europeans and the Ukrainians into accepting a deal that he, Donald Trump, likes. So Trump has come to the conclusion, quite clearly, that there are limits to his power. And given that he can't force an agreement on the two sides, let's let them deal with the problem. In other words, let's let the Europeans and the Ukrainians deal with Putin. And of course, all of this means that this will be settled on the battlefield.
So you would argue that there is no silver lining at the moment, that there is a negotiable peace. We will see, unfortunately, the end of this conflict on the battlefield.
I'm sad to say that that's the case. I have yet to hear anybody put forward a peace formula that even comes close to satisfying both sides. I mean, the two sides, the Ukrainians and the Europeans on one side, and the Russians on the other side, are so far apart there is no way you can work out a deal. You know, what President Trump wants to do is he wants to basically force Zelensky and Putin to have a meeting. Where he's not present, where the two of them are present, and then they'll have another meeting and President Trump will be involved as a moderator at that meeting. That's his ideal situation. But the question I would ask is, if you have a meeting between Presidents Zelensky and Putin, what good is that meeting going to do when they can't agree on anything? I mean, what are they going to talk about? A possible peace agreement? That would be a waste of time because they are operating on different planets. They just, you know, don't agree at all. So there's no silver lining here.
How do you explain that the Europeans and also President Zelensky don't see your argument? I mean, you have expressed it on many occasions eloquently. You have said, well, you would give the advice to the Ukrainian president, even though it's very bitter what he has to face, the best would be to take the deal right now to side with President Trump, because if he continues to fight, this will be an even bigger disaster for the Ukraine. So how do you explain that these politicians insist so much on a strategy that you would say it's disastrous?
Yeah, I think about this question all the time. And I mean, I'm tempted to say it's because the European leaders and President Zelensky are irrational and they don't pay attention to facts and logic. But I think really what's going on here is that they've convinced themselves that the Russians are in deep trouble. They believe that Russia has severe economic problems, and those problems will only get worse with the passage of time. And furthermore, they believe that on the battlefield, the Russians are suffering enormous casualties. The Ukrainians are inflicting massive damage on the fighting forces on the Russian side. And at some point, the Russian army is going to collapse, or it's going to want to stop the fighting. And if the United States continues to support Ukraine and the Europeans continue to support Ukraine, Ukraine will have a great deal of leverage in future negotiations with Russia. Again, because the Russian economy will be hurting and because the Russians will be suffering on the battlefield and because the Americans and the Europeans will be backing Ukraine to the hilt. I think this is the story that they tell themselves. But it's a remarkably foolish story. The sanctions have not worked as intended. And all this talk about secondary sanctions is a waste of time because the Americans have figured out that secondary sanctions aren't going to work either. Furthermore, if you look at what's happening on the battlefield, the Ukrainians are in deep trouble because they don't have enough manpower. It's not weaponry. It's manpower now that is their Achilles heel. And there's nothing the West can do to solve the manpower problem. And furthermore, they're in trouble in terms of weaponry, and there's not much we can do there either. So they're going to lose on the battlefield. And the idea that the Russians are the ones who are suffering enormous casualties and it's not the Ukrainians has it backwards. It's the Ukrainians, not the Russians, who are suffering greater casualties on the battlefield. And the Russians are, in my opinion, not far away from winning this war. And if you read the newspapers, even in the West, carefully, and you listen to the accounts of what's going on in the fighting, it's quite clear the Ukrainians are in deep trouble. And then finally, with regard to the Americans, as I said in response to your first question, the Americans are very subtly withdrawing from this conflict and turning responsibility over to the Europeans and the Ukrainians. So the idea that you're going to get a greater contribution from the Americans is, I think, wrongheaded. So all of these things tell me that the story that I think the European elites and President Zelensky are telling to themselves is basically a fairy tale.
Do you think that politicians such as Friedrich Merz, Ursula von der Leyen, Keir Starmer, all these people who were present yesterday in Washington, are they convinced that they still can win this war against Russia militarily on the battlefield? Or do we see some kind of cynical aspect in this whole arrangement here? How do you analyze this?
I think that they do believe that they can slowly stem the tide, not win right away. They can stem the tide, and then they can inflict massive casualties on the Russians, and they can then begin to turn the tide and push the Russians back. Now, you may say, how can they possibly believe this given what's actually happening on the battlefield? I think it's important to understand that the Europeans and President Zelensky himself and many other Ukrainians are motivated to tell themselves a happy story because they have been waging this war for over 3 years now. And they have been waging it on the premise that they were ultimately going to win. For them to admit defeat at this point in time would be extremely difficult to do, extremely difficult. And I think when leaders are in a situation like that, they look for stories that they can tell themselves that lead to a happy ending. I think if we can just delay the inevitable, which is losing, some miracle will happen. You saw this with regard to the Americans in Afghanistan. It was clear after, I would argue, about 5-6 years that we were not going to win in Afghanistan. It was certainly clear after 10 years. It took us 20 years to get out of Afghanistan, 20 years, and we lost. And all sorts of people wanted to stay in Afghanistan. And if you ask them, why should we stay in Afghanistan? How are we ultimately going to prevail in Afghanistan? They had no real story, certainly no compelling story, but they just wanted to stay because they didn't want to admit defeat. And they thought maybe there would be a miracle at some point in the future. And by the way, this was true during the Vietnam War as well. I think we'd still be in Vietnam today if Congress hadn't finally cracked down and told the Nixon administration and then the Ford administration that you have to end this war. But the Ford administration, especially Henry Kissinger, who was his Secretary of State at the time, they did not want to leave Vietnam. They wanted to stay. They wanted to fight. We did not want to lose in Vietnam. And again, I think European leaders today and President Zelensky and his lieutenants do not want to lose. And they're, you know, desperate to find a story as to how they can prevail.
We find ourselves in an absurd situation. On the one hand, we have seen in Alaska some kind of thaw between Trump and Putin, good atmosphere, well-mannered conversations. You could even speak of some kind of friendly exchanges. On the other hand, you have Europe, the European Union, one of the closest allies of the United States, you know, building up piles of weapon and in preparation for a war against Russia. As you know, our experts here in Germany, also in Switzerland, say that Russia is planning an attack on NATO. We have to defend ourselves. And on the other hand, we have friendly relationship between the United States and Russia. I mean, how do you explain this absurdity of the whole situation?
Well, you want to remember, in his first term in office, between 2017 and 2021, President Trump wanted to have good relations with Putin and with Russia more generally. The deep state or the blob or the foreign policy establishment, call it whatever you want, in the United States was adamantly opposed to that. So what Trump did in his first administration is he fundamentally altered U.S. relations with China. You want to remember, it was President Trump who abandoned engagement with China and adopted a containment policy. The other policy, again, that he wanted to pursue was to have a rapprochement with Russia and actually to form an alliance with Russia against China. He completely failed. This time, he plans to go back to that issue and actually improve relations with Russia and in particular with Putin. The fact is that Trump likes Putin. Putin is his kind of guy. Putin is powerful. He's a first-class strategist. And Trump is someone who respects power. He respects powerful people. If you show weakness around Trump, he'll browbeat you. He does not ever fail to take advantage of weakness. But when he's dealing with Trump, when he's dealing with Putin, he's dealing with a powerful actor in the system. And he understands that. And he respects Putin. He wants to have good relations with Putin. So that's really what's going on here. With regard to the Europeans, the Russophobia in places like Britain has historically been very great. Nothing's changed on that count. And the Russophobia in Europe since 2014 has been acute. And very little has changed with regard to that. To make matters worse, and this gets to the second issue that you raised, European leaders have to mobilize their publics to support European policy toward Russia and toward Ukraine. And the way you do that is you threat inflate. You paint this picture of a Russian boogeyman, of a Russian threat that has to be dealt with. You tell a story where Ukraine is the first line of defense. And if the Russians take all of Ukraine, as you say they are destined to do, they're then going to take territory in Eastern Europe, and they're eventually going to put their gun sights on Western Europe. This is basically like dealing with the Third Reich. This is like dealing with Adolf Hitler. The Russian army is like the Wehrmacht. And if we don't stop them now, we'll make the fatal mistake that Chamberlain made at Munich in September of 1938. This is the story that the elites tell. Of course, it's fundamentally at odds with the story that Trump is telling, and it's fundamentally at odds with Trump's behavior in Alaska on Friday. There's no question about that. But the Europeans are committed to this narrative, and they're committed to this narrative because threat inflation is so important for them maintaining public support for increased spending on defense and for continuing to get European publics to support the policy towards Ukraine. And this just adds to the Russophobia and leads to the present situation that we're in. If you want, we could talk about the fact that the idea that Russia is bent on conquering all of Ukraine is nonsense. Mm-hmm. The idea that it's going to conquer Eastern Europe and threaten the rest of Europe is also nonsense.
But it's very interesting what you're saying, but this argument that we are in a situation like, you know, Chamberlain before the Second World War, this is a notion that powerful people in Germany, also in the publishing field, they cling to. And they say that's exactly the case, and everybody who has a different opinion is an appeaser. So how would you, as a strategist, as a connoisseur of history, what would be your most effective argument against these appeasement interpreters of today? Where are they wrong?
Well, first of all, let's just talk about the capabilities. Russia has spent the past 3.5 years trying to expand its foothold in eastern Ukraine, and it has barely conquered any more territory than it had in 2022 in eastern Ukraine. The idea that Russia is this juggernaut, and it has this military that's the equivalent of the Wehrmacht and can easily overrun all of Ukraine, is belied by the facts. Just look at the performance of the Russian military over the past 3+ years. Does this look like the second coming of the Wehrmacht? Certainly doesn't look like that to me. Second point I'd make to you is that Putin has never once said that he was interested in conquering all of Ukraine. He has never once said that he had any territorial goals in Eastern Europe, much less Western Europe. The third point I'd make on this is that President Putin would be remarkably foolish to try to conquer all of Ukraine, because the western one half of Ukraine is filled with ethnic Ukrainians who hate the Russians and would go to enormous lengths to resist a Russian occupation. What's the story here that European leaders are telling? They're saying that Putin is going to conquer and occupy all of Ukraine, and then he's going to integrate it into a greater Russia. This is not going to happen. Putin fully understands that. We live in the age of nationalism. Putin fully understands the power of Ukrainian nationalism. He fully understands that the Ukrainians have fought like wild dogs for 3+ years because they will do anything they can to resist Russian conquest of their territory. This is not going to change when Putin conquers all of Ukraine. Let me make another point on this. When the Germans launched World War II on September 1st, 1939, and went into Poland, and you want to remember, the Germans only conquered the western one half of Poland. They were not going in to conquer all of Poland, because the Soviet Union, as a result of the von Ribbentrop-Molotov Pact, was going to conquer the eastern one half of Poland. So here you have a situation where the Germans go in for the purpose of conquering, occupying, and taking large parts of Poland and incorporating it into the Third Reich. How many troops do the Germans go in to Poland with on September 1st, 1939? The answer is 1.5 million troops. Yeah. 1.5 million troops. Ukraine, as we all know, is a much, much bigger piece of territory than the western one half of Poland. When the Russians invaded on February 24th, 2022, General Sirski, who now heads the Ukrainian forces, has said on the record that the Russians went in with 100,000 troops. I say they went in with 190,000 troops. I use a more conservative estimate than he does. Whether you have 100,000 troops or 190,000 troops, you are not going to conquer all of Ukraine. Just not going to happen. And of course, it did not happen because the Russians were not interested in conquering all of Ukraine. And indeed, that's why they entered into the Istanbul negotiations almost immediately after invading Ukraine, because they had no interest in conquering all of Ukraine, and they did not have the capability. This army doesn't even have 1 million men in Ukraine, and it's not going to have 1 million men in Ukraine. And you'd need well over 1 million men to conquer all of Ukraine. Final point, Roger, if they conquer all of Ukraine, the Russians will be in deep trouble. They will be dealing with a resistance from the Ukrainians that is incredibly difficult to neutralize. Therefore, they will be in no position to invade Eastern Europe, much less Western Europe. So the idea that Russia is this threat to conquer all of Europe. It's the second coming of the Soviet Union. This is like May 1945, where the Russian army or the Red Army is in Berlin with hundreds of divisions and is poised to head for Dunkirk. It's a ridiculous argument. This is threat inflation of the worst sort, and it's what gets in the way of having a realistic analysis of the situation, and in my opinion, doing what is best for Ukraine. What we're doing now is not what's smart for Ukraine. It's foolish. It's just making a bad situation worse.
Looking back at these 3 years of war from a Russian perspective, has President Putin achieved his goals? Are the initial interests and factors that he wanted to clear with this war, did he achieve that? Or was this war, from the Russian point of view, a tragical error?
Well, the question you have to ask yourself is, why did Putin start the war? And in my story, he started the war because he was profoundly committed to making sure that Ukraine did not become a Western bulwark on Russia's border. It's very important to understand that the West, and here we're talking mainly about the United States at the time, was interested in making Ukraine a Western bulwark on Russia's border. And the key element in the West strategy was NATO expansion into Ukraine. And from a Russian point of view, that was an existential threat. I understand that many people in the West refuse to believe that line of argument. They do not think that NATO expansion into Ukraine was an existential threat. But what they care, what they think, doesn't matter. What matters is what Putin and his lieutenants thought. And they thought, and they continue to think, that Ukraine in NATO is an existential threat. And they started the war, the Russians started the war on February 24th, 2022, for the purpose of preventing Ukraine from joining NATO. They have been successful in that regard. And furthermore, they worried about Ukraine becoming a serious military threat to Russia. And what has happened is that Ukraine is being turned into a dysfunctional rump state. And Ukraine in no way will be a threat to Russia moving forward, nor, as I said, will it be in NATO. So in the end, Putin will have achieved his principal objectives. I think that it's quite clear from what was happening in the run-up to the war. This is in December of 2021, January of 2021, and the first half of February 2021, that Putin was doing everything he could to avoid a war. I know this is not a popular argument in the West, but if you go back and you look at what the Russians were doing, the Russians were trying to avoid a war. And it was the Americans, it's quite remarkable, it was the Americans who had no interest in negotiating with Putin and avoiding this war. The Russians were running around, the Americans were running around in December, January, February, right before the war started, saying that the Russians are likely to attack Ukraine. The Americans were making that argument. Why weren't the Americans trying to prevent a war? Why weren't they going to great lengths to negotiate with the Russians to avoid this war that they were predicting? I don't know, other than it seems like the Americans welcomed the war because the Americans thought that they could, with sanctions and with the Ukrainian army on the battlefield, bring the Russians to their knees. But the Americans and the West more generally made no effort to accommodate Russia in the run-up to the war when people in the West, especially the United States, thought a war was inevitable. Then the war breaks out. The Russians, very important to emphasize this, the Russians immediately reach out to the Ukrainians and say, let's start negotiating. Let's start negotiating an end to the war. This is right after it starts. And as you well know, those talks begin. And in Istanbul, these are the famous Istanbul negotiations in March 2022, early April 2022. Now, the question you have to ask yourself is, why did those negotiations end? Especially since there was lots of evidence that the two sides, Ukraine and Russia, were moving toward a peace agreement. It's quite clear that those negotiations ended because the United States and the British, in the form of Boris Johnson, told the Ukrainians to walk away from the negotiations. And again, those negotiations looked like they were going to bear fruit. But we, mainly the United States, told them to walk away. We were not interested in a peace deal. We were interested in continuing the war. But what's happened over time is, of course, the balance of power in that war has shifted, and the Russians are now in the driver's seat.
Underestimation of Russia once again. Before we talk about a possible paradigm shift in the Russian-American relationship after Alaska, I have to ask you a question about President Zelensky. I mean, in Switzerland, in Germany, he is the ultimate hero. I mean, the newspapers, the politicians, they have rolled out the red carpet. They say he's like a saint. He's the bravest politician. He is courageous. He defends his country. His policies are without alternative. What's your assessment of President Zelensky? Is he a hero or is he a failure in regard of the national interest of Ukraine?
Well, the question you want to ask yourself is, when all is said and done, what is going to be the end result of Ukraine's policy regarding Russia and Ukraine's policy during this war? And the end result is that Ukraine is going to end up losing a large chunk of its territory, and it's going to be a dysfunctional rump state. And in my book, that's failure. This is not success. The idea that Zelensky has won, has been successful so far, that argument can't be sustained. And of course, this gets back to our earlier discussion where we talked about why Zelensky and the Europeans want to continue the war. It's because they want to rescue the situation. They're not going to rescue the situation. The situation is only going to get worse. The fact is that the Russians are winning on the battlefield, and there is nothing the Ukrainians can do to stem the tide and recapture that lost territory. It's not going to happen. What's going to happen if Ukraine continues the war is that it's going to lose more people, and it's going to lose more territory. And it's still going to end up as a dysfunctional rump state. This is a disaster. This war should have been shut down by Zelensky a long time ago. He should have told the Americans at the time of the Istanbul negotiations that he was committed to working out a deal with the Russians. Ukraine would be in infinitely better shape today if Zelensky had stuck to his guns and not listened to the Americans and Boris Johnson in April of 2022. And people like me have been arguing for well over a year now that the Ukrainians should cut a deal. They should accept the fact that they're going to lose some territory and that they can't join NATO, that Ukraine has to be a neutral state. I can understand why the Ukrainians don't want to do that. I fully understand. But we're talking here about what's the least bad alternative at this point. Not what's a great alternative. There are no great alternatives. What's the least bad alternative? The least bad alternative is to shut this war down, make sure you don't lose any more territory than you've already lost, and make sure you don't lose any more Ukrainians than you've already lost. But President Zelensky, with backing from the Europeans, refuses to accept my logic and the logic that other people purvey as well. I'm, of course, not the only person making that argument. But people like me are certainly in the minority in Europe. Mm-hmm. And people on the other side, they think they control the moral high ground. They mm-hmm. think the morally correct thing to do is to continue fighting. I think that if anything, the morally correct thing to do, as well as the strategically correct thing to do from Ukraine's point of view, is to end the war. But apparently that's not happening, at least diplomatically. I think it will end militarily, but not to Ukraine's advantage. So my bottom line here is that President Zelensky, who I fully understand is in an incredibly difficult situation, has nevertheless done a poor job of managing his country's national security.
Also in a bad situation of his own making. I mean, how does the war end on the battlefield? I mean, it's interesting. If you look back, for example, in the First World War, and we look at the Germans who had no troops on their own territory in 1918, it was, interestingly, their generals. It was Hindenburg and Ludendorff who said, we're actually collapsing on the battlefield. Of course, the home front was falling apart too, but then you get the backstab theory and everything, which they brought up. But somehow there, the German army broke on the battlefield, and then finally also the political situation fell apart, according to my knowledge. How will it happen in Ukraine? We see that there is some resistance from prominent politicians. For example, Vitaly Klitschko has said, well, we have to negotiate, even if we give up territory, that must be on the table. We see those polls, 76-78% of the people are against continuation of the war. We see that many young men are leaving the country of Ukraine. How will it come to an end? What's your analysis of this?
Yeah, very interesting question, Roger. Let me just say a few words about the German case and then use that as a stepping stone to talk about what I think is likely to happen in Ukraine. It's very important to understand that the German army launched a series of offensives in March 1918 and looked like it might win the war. Looked like Germany might win the war. This is in March 1918. And remember, the war ends in November of 1918, a few months later. So what happens? What happens is the German offensive ultimately fails. And at that point in time, the American army is coming into the fight in huge numbers. Huge numbers. Huge numbers of American soldiers are being sent across the Atlantic Ocean in the wake of a failed German offensive. So what this tells you is that the balance of power on the battlefield is shifting in marked ways against Germany. And Germany has been fighting since 1914. So this is an exhausted army that is now facing a shifting balance of power. And slowly but steadily, the Allies, with American forces coming to the fore, begin to make small gains against the Germans. Mm-hmm. So what's happening on the battlefield is bad news for Germany. The second point, and this is of great importance, is that on the home front, the blockade that the British and the Americans have put on Germany and on Austria-Hungary is really beginning to have a deadly effect. And many civilians are not only starving, they're dying. So the pressure on the home front to end this war is growing because of the blockade. So it's a combination of loss of support for the war at home, plus losing on the battlefield as a result of the Americans coming into the fight, that causes Germany to surrender before, as you said, Allied troops ever set foot inside of Germany. Now, let's fast forward to the case regarding Ukraine.
Very interesting, yeah.
What we want to do is focus on the battlefield and on the home front. Just to go to the battlefield, The Ukrainians are in a desperate situation on the battlefield, by almost all accounts, because they don't have enough infantry. They don't have enough infantry to cover the front lines. They can't thickly populate the front lines with infantry to hold off Russian attacks. So the Russians are able to penetrate the Ukrainians' front lines because they are so thinly manned. This is a disastrous situation, and the Ukrainians have no way of fixing it. Mm-hmm. And again, as I said before, there's nothing the West can do to fix this problem. So if you look at what's happening on the battlefield, the Russians, who are mobilizing more and more troops every month, in contrast to the Ukrainians, are clearly in the driver's seat. Mm-hmm. And the Ukrainians understand this. And you have large numbers of desertions. You have people who are refusing to go up to the front lines because they don't want to die in what they think is a hopeless cause, right? So in terms of the battlefield, it doesn't look that different from what was happening in Germany after the summer, or starting in the summer of 1918. With regard to the home front, as you pointed out, support for the war inside of Ukraine is evaporating. You've had a fundamental shift in public opinion. Zelensky remains as hawkish as ever, and he has a number of advisors who fit the same description. But there are other leaders in Ukraine who see the writing on the wall. And of course, large chunks of the public see the writing on the wall. So again, you see a situation that's somewhat analogous to the situation that we had with Germany in 1918. And who can say for sure how this is going to play out? But I find it hard to imagine that at some point Ukrainian resistance will just break down and the Ukrainian forces will stop fighting and you will end up with a frozen conflict. But to make it very clear here, I do not believe the Russians would then try to conquer all of Ukraine. As I said before, I think that would be remarkably foolish. I think the Russians will take more territory, if they can, than the four oblasts and Crimea, which they have now formally annexed. I think the Russians will try to take Odessa, they'll try to take Kharkiv and a few other of the oblasts if the Ukrainian army collapses. And again, this is why I think Ukraine should cut a deal now before it loses any more territory. But I do think that if you look at the situation on the battlefield and the situation on the Ukrainian home front, it's hard to see Ukraine avoiding collapse.
I mean, you're pointing out that it's a huge tragedy when the Ukraine, which is quite probable now, is continuing this war, which it cannot win. A settlement, a peace agreement would be a better solution. Let's look at Europe. I mean, the Europeans, they seem to be in this surreal position that they think, well, you know, we can afford continuing or helping the Ukraine to win this war, which they won't win. Now, can you explain what is the difference for Europe between a peace settlement diplomatically, as probably President Trump is proposing it, and what has Europe to lose if they continue this useless war against Russia, which they cannot win either? Because I think this sensitivity, what is at stake for the Europeans, is somehow not there. You know, they think they're making the brave thing, they do the moral right thing if they support Ukraine. They don't see it as you do in the light of national interest and, you know, clear-cut basic facts of life.
I think what the Europeans fear, and I think the Americans fear this to some extent, is that this will be a devastating defeat for them, right? These European leaders, people like Keir Starmer, Macron, and so forth and so on, they have been deeply committed to defeating the Russians from the get-go. And this will be a humiliating defeat for them. And by the way, the same thing would be true for Joe Biden if he were still the president of the United States, because Biden was deeply committed to this war. It's much easier for Trump to walk away because he didn't start the war. And he's long argued that it was a foolish war. So Trump's in a very different position than the European leaders are. But it would be a humiliating defeat for them. The other thing that they greatly fear is that it will lead to the disintegration of NATO. I mean, this was all about bringing Ukraine into NATO. This war was, and it's really a case of NATO almost going to war against Russia. I mean, it was not technically a war between Russia on one side, NATO on the other, but it was almost a war between the two sides, and NATO's going to lose. And this is, I think, unthinkable to many people in the West. And it's one of the reasons that they're going to great lengths to prevent it from happening. So I think that's really what's going on here. By the way, with regard to Trump, not only does Trump not consider this his war, and not only does he constantly say that if he had been president, the war wouldn't have happened, but as we know, Trump has a lot of contempt for the Europeans, and he basically has no use for NATO. I believe that if NATO were to collapse tomorrow, Trump would be satisfied. Destroying NATO is not a high priority for him, but he has little use for NATO. He has little use for the Europeans. And again, he likes Putin. So you have this very interesting situation where the European leaders think about NATO, think about Russia, and think about Putin in fundamentally different ways than Trump does.
And probably it will play out this way, that these governments that have been represented yesterday in Washington will not be there in a short period of time, because there is also a growing number of Europeans who are fed up with this war, and they think Europe should have better relationship with Russia. We should start to cooperate again, because the price Europe is paying, with this war, with all the sanctions, it's just too high. And these group of people yesterday in Washington might not be in charge in a quite short period of time.
I agree with that. You know, we haven't talked about this, and I actually hardly ever talk about it, but it's a very important point, and that is that the Europeans have suffered as a result of this war, mainly economically. If you look at the consequences of this war for Germany, Germany would have been much better off without a war and maintaining good economic relations and political relations with Russia. Mm-hmm. So the Europeans are paying a real price here. And by the way, I would note to you that you're in all likelihood going to get a frozen conflict here. You're not going to get a genuine peace agreement for all the reasons we talked about this at the start of the show. But you get a frozen conflict, and that frozen conflict, in my opinion, means that you're going to have poisonous relations between Russia on one side and Ukraine and Europe on the other. So as Europe looks forward to how it's going to deal with Russia over time, I don't think you're going to have positive or good or cordial relations. You're probably going to have terrible relations, because the Europeans are going to want revenge. Not all of them, but some of them. The Americans are going to want revenge, and the Ukrainians are going to want revenge. And the idea that Russia is going to settle this war and everybody's going to live happily ever after, I don't think that's true. This is why I argue, Roger, that if you go back to that April 2008 decision to bring Ukraine into NATO.
And Georgia.
And Georgia as well. Yeah, again, you want to remember, in August of 2008, there was a war over Georgia on this very issue. Georgia was interested in joining NATO. This is in August 2008, after the April 2008 declaration that Georgia and Ukraine would become members of NATO. That did not work out very well. This is not working out very well. And again, I want to emphasize, as I have many times in the past, that at the April 2008 Bucharest summit, where a decree was issued that said Ukraine and Georgia would become part of NATO, both Angela Merkel and Nicolas Sarkozy adamantly opposed that declaration. They did not want to move to bring Ukraine into NATO. And Merkel said, and these words are very important, she said that the reason she opposed bringing Ukraine into NATO is that she understood that Putin would interpret it as a declaration of war. Just want to think about that. Hmm. Merkel understood that Putin would interpret it as a declaration of war, which of course he did. And we got that war in 2022. And it has been disastrous for everyone concerned, hmm. most importantly for the Ukrainians. This war is a total disaster for Ukraine. It's a catastrophe. Hmm. But it has also been disastrous for the Europeans from an economic point of view more than anything else. And it's been disastrous for the Russians. The Russians didn't need this war. The Americans don't need this war. It's a foolish decision in the extreme that was made in April of 2008.
And now there is an extremely interesting point I read in a Russian newspaper after the summit in Alaska. There was one of the prominent analysts and writers. He was arguing that the summit in Alaska was somehow a climate change situation in the relationship between Russia and the United States of America. And they wrote that this could be the beginning of the end of exactly this strategy you now described, the strategy of the United States of America of trying to strategically weaken Russia after the Cold War, you know, to poke the bear, to expand NATO ever closer to the Russian borders, even going into Ukraine, which is a very peculiar and special territory in the Russian mindset. So the Russians, they are somehow enthusiastic, or some of them, and they say, well, this is now a new beginning of a great relationship between Russia and the United States, this cordial summit in Alaska. Are these hopes justified, or do you think that after this short sun, there will be the winter again in the American-Russian relationship? Well, let's look a bit into the crystal ball. What are you saying?
Well, I think that Russian enthusiasm should be qualified. and the reason is that Donald Trump is something of an anomaly in the United States. It's very important to understand that inside the American foreign policy establishment, the overwhelming majority of people, this is inside the American national security establishment, the overwhelming majority of people think about Putin and think about Russia and think about Ukraine the way most Europeans do. Trump is an outlier, and he has taken significant criticism from people on the right and on the left in the foreign policy establishment regarding his views on Russia. So Trump is not going to be president forever. He's only going to be president for 3+ more years. And who knows who will replace him. But there are Republicans like Lindsey Graham, mm-hmm. who are extremely hawkish on Russia. And there are Democrats, who are extremely hawkish on Russia. So if you get, you know, the second coming of Joe Biden, in 2028, we may do a 180-degree turn. Who knows for sure? These things are very hard to say. But if I were the Russians, I would not bank on having good relations with the United States forever. Mm-hmm. See what's going to happen here, Roger, and it gets back to your discussion of what's going on in Europe. You pointed out before that the governing elites in Europe today, almost to a person, there are some exceptions like Viktor Orban, mm-hmm. but almost all the governing elites in Europe today are deeply hostile to Putin and to Russia, and they want to continue to support Ukraine. But down below in the public, there's a lot of opposition to that policy. And you are going to get, we don't know how many, but you're going to get some leaders in some of the major countries who want to fundamentally change policy in their country toward Ukraine and toward Russia, just like happened in the United States when President Trump came into office earlier this year. So you have, in the future, in Europe, a very fluid situation coming in terms of how the leaders think about dealing with Russia. And what I'm saying to you is that you're going to have a similar situation in the United States. You just can't say that we're going to have a Trump-like foreign policy towards Russia forever. We may get someone like Joe Biden in 2028. You just can't know. And the same thing is true in various European countries. Mm-hmm. All of this tells you that the political landscape, the transatlantic political landscape, is going to be very complicated moving forward. And this is going to provide all sorts of opportunities for the Russians to exploit those differences. Mm-hmm. And you want to remember, we in the West are going to go to great lengths to cause the Russians trouble in those areas of Ukraine that they end up annexing. We're not going to be satisfied with Russia annexing Ukrainian territory. We're going to give Russia lots of trouble, we meaning the West, mm-hmm. as the Ukrainians will as well. The Russians, of course, will reciprocate. And as I say to you, they'll be dealing with fertile territory because of political differences between the various states in the West concerning how to deal with Russia.
Interestingly, China does not play a role in this peace process. I mean, when we read the newspapers, also like 1 year ago, it was always, you know, they thought, well, China could come in at some point, etc. But we see more of a situation when President Nixon went to Beijing back in the 70s to talk to the Grandmaster Mao there in his palace in order to separate a bit, you know, the Chinese from the Russians, etc. So how do you explain that China is somehow has somehow disappeared from this peace negotiations? You don't hear anything or almost anything from the Chinese. How to explain this?
I'd make 2 points. First of all, it makes no sense for the Chinese to get involved in this mess because there's nothing they could do to fix it, and they would just be implicated. If you're smart, you just stay on the sidelines. There's no solution here. It's not like the Chinese have the magic solution or the Chinese have the coercive leverage to solve this one. They don't. So if you can't fix it, stay out. That would be point number one. Point number two is the Chinese don't want to come in because that would mean they would have to be somewhat neutral. They would have to act as a moderating force. And that would mean that they wouldn't be able to maintain their almost total allegiance to Russia, which is in their national interest. If you're China, what you want to do here is you want to remain joined at the hip with Russia. This war is manna from heaven for the Chinese because it's driven the Russians into the arms of the Chinese. The Russians and the Chinese are extremely close. And from a Chinese point of view, this is wonderful news. So what you want to do is do everything you can to maximize the closeness of that relationship that you have with Moscow. And the best way to do that is stay out of the negotiations, where you'd be forced to be more sympathetic to the Ukrainians, and stay on the sidelines and back the Russians to the hilt.
Mm-hmm. Now, if I look at the American president, and I'm quite impressed what he does, also his diplomatic activities, you know, his engagement, bringing in Putin, taking him out of the leprous station of world policy, you know, rehabilitating him, legitimizing him somehow. He gets criticized for that. But still, you know, diplomacy comes back, talk to each other. He tries to talk to the Europeans, etc., etc. I have a positive image of the intense activity of the American president. I even wrote that he could be a game changer in international politics, but I see that you have a more well, let's say, gloomy or more realistic view of everything. And I'm still trying to find some kind of silver lining here. What do you make of President Trump's foreign policy? Do you see it as erratic? Do you see it as inspiring? What's your assessment of that?
I think that in many ways, President Trump has the right instincts. This is certainly true in the case of Russia and the Ukraine conflict. The problem is in the execution. If you think about the Ukraine war, he took office on January 20th of this year. And he said before he took office that he would either solve the Ukraine war before he moved into the White House, but he would certainly solve it after he moved into the White House. And of course, he completely failed. And the question you want to ask yourself is, why did he fail? Now, part of the explanation is that this is a remarkably complicated issue. Mm-hmm. Nobody could easily solve this problem. I think, Roger, if they put you and me in charge on January 21st, it's not clear we could have shut it down. Mm-hmm. It's that tricky. But the fact is that Trump thought that he could do it without studying the issue carefully and managing the issue carefully. Trump tends to fly by the seat of your pants. He tends to think that he's a genius. He doesn't need much advice. And he can just deal with these problems rather easily because of his talents. And that's a remarkably foolish way to think about these problems, especially the Ukraine war. And then if you look at who he relied on to help him solve this problem, he mainly relied on Steve Witkoff. Steve Witkoff is a real estate mogul from New York City. He has no experience in diplomacy. He does not know that much about foreign policy to begin with. And furthermore, not only that, but he assigns Witkoff three portfolios, the Iran portfolio, the Israel-Palestine portfolio, and the Ukraine portfolio. Mm-hmm. So you have this guy, Witkoff, who doesn't have a lot of experience, doesn't have a lot of knowledge, dealing with three problems, three really huge problems, doesn't have a lot of staff, and it's Witkoff and Trump, who together, you know, think they're going to do this, mm-hmm. and who think they're going to get the job done, and obviously that didn't work out very well at all. So I think if you look at President Trump's performance on Ukraine, I think he had good intentions, but he just failed to execute.
It was interesting that he said yesterday he first thought it would be a very easy conflict to solve, but now he realized it's probably the most complicated one, which is an honesty, which is quite rare in those circles. Now, to sum and to end our conversation, many thanks for your precious time. And we talked about these big Leviathan countries, these big behemoths. Now we have to talk about the very small country, which is Switzerland. We have to survive in this jungle of these predator countries all around us. Since many, many years, Switzerland has to do that. And of course, in our country, the discussion circles around Swiss neutrality. As you probably know, Switzerland has somehow pushed a bit aside its neutrality in the war, in the Ukraine war. We participated in the sanctions. There is a political debate now whether we should fully implement neutrality again in Switzerland. Could you say something from your perspective as the eminent expert on realpolitik? I mean, what's the worth of a neutral country like Switzerland in today's world? Is that still a precious value? How does Professor John Mearsheimer, assess neutrality, and especially the Swiss neutrality, which is permanent, armed, and integral? I mean, as they say, you know, all encompassing, also non-economic warfare, no military participation in foreign wars. What's your take on that?
Well, I would point out, as you well know, that neutrality has served Switzerland very well in the past, and that Switzerland was neutral during World War I, when Imperial Germany was the most powerful country in Europe, threatened to dominate Europe, and was effectively a next-door neighbor of Switzerland. Then came Nazi Germany 20 years later, and again, Switzerland was neutral, and it managed to survive without much trouble. And of course, then came the Cold War, with the Soviet Union on one side and the United States on the other side. And Switzerland was neutral, and it survived very well, thank you. What's the situation today? Is there an Imperial Germany out there? Is there a Nazi Germany out there? Is there a Soviet Union out there? Of course not. What's the threat? What's the strategic threat to Switzerland? There is none. So my initial inclination is to say there's no reason to abandon neutrality. If there was no reason to abandon neutrality in 1914, 1939, and 1945, why would you abandon neutrality in 2025? It just doesn't seem to make sense to me. And by the way, I make the same argument about Finland joining NATO. Finland survived very well during the Cold War as a neutral state and not becoming a member of NATO. Why did it join NATO 2 years ago? It just doesn't seem to make sense to me, especially since there's no serious threat from Russia. Russia is certainly not the equivalent of the Soviet Union in terms of threatening Finland. So I think Finland made a mistake. So my inclination is to say that Switzerland should remain neutral.
Do you think that the European Union in its current institutional form has a future?
I think there's no question it has a future. The question is, what does that future look like? My view, Roger, on the European Union is that what made it very successful over time was in large part NATO. NATO provided a firm security environment for Europe, for Western Europe during the Cold War, and then when the Cold War ended, for almost all of Europe. And as long as you had this well-established security framework in Europe, which came as a result of NATO, and NATO really involves the Americans being involved in Europe. This is the American pacifier argument. What NATO is the American pacifier. You had the Americans sitting on top of Europe, acting as a pacifier. And when you have a stable security environment, it is possible for an institution like the European Union to flourish. And it did flourish. Now, the question is, what does the world look like moving forward? And I think there are good reasons to think that NATO is going to weaken greatly over time. And as a consequence, the European Union will weaken over time. I think as the security environment changes, as the American pacifier begins to move away from Europe, this will have consequences in the economic realm. And those centrifugal forces that are always at play inside an institution like the European Union will pick up speed. And therefore, the European Union moving forward will not be as effective as it has been in the past.
And we see those tendencies already. The difficulty in finding a common foreign policy in a difficult and dangerous environment. Well, Professor Mearsheimer, dear John, thanks a lot for your time. That was excellent. And we covered a lot of space. And I'm really grateful that we could have this conversation.
My pleasure, Roger. Thank you very much for having me on the show.